Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Coming up on the show, if you're a record collector or just a fan of rare audio, stick around, because Amanda Petrusich is here to talk about her new book, Do Not Sell at Any Price. It's about the diehard cult that, you should pardon the pun, revolves around 78 RPM records. Plus, our home station, WNYC, turns 90 years old this week, and to celebrate, we're digging into the archives again. Tonight, we'll hear an appearance by the blues legend Leadbelly, who actually had a show on WNYC, with his good friend Woody Guthrie. But first, we'll stay a little closer to the present day. Sort of. All this month on Soundcheck, we're celebrating music from the summer of 1994, and for some reason, our producers have cooked up this theme song. Fortunately, our listeners have been offering up a bunch of great songs from that summer 20 years ago.
My name is Shannon, and I'm from Woodbridge, New Jersey. In the summer of 94, I was listening to Nirvana. Green Day.
Do you have the time to listen to me whine?
Biggie Smalls.
Throw your hands in the air if you's a true player.
And Four Non-Blondes. Those were some of my favorite groups in the summer of 94. I said, hey, what's going on in our
them? Hey, yeah, yeah, hey, yeah, yeah. I said, hey, what's going on? Hey, Andrew, I live in Detroit, and I was living in Detroit in 1994, my first $9,000 house, and I was ripping it apart. And I remember listening to Hater, Sub Pop band, you know, kind of Soundgarden offshoot stuff. Folk Implosion. Sputnik's down. Spread her guts on towns around. Sputnik's down. Spread her guts on towns around. Sputnik's down. Elliot Smith. I wanna hurt him. I wanna give him pain. I'm a Roman candle. My head is full of flames. And, Beck, probably. Probably Mellow Gold was in there too. Thanks. And they were singing like this. Why don't throw in Frisbee at the sun? Put my soul between the bones. Now I'm running, now I'm drunk. Now I'm running like a flaming pig. Oh yeah. Scraping off the attitude. Old man eating all my food. Don't be kind, don't be rude. Just shake your boots and let it all get loose.
Thanks to Andrew from Detroit and Shannon from Woodbridge, New Jersey. So, what were you doing in 1994? Fixing up a $9,000 house like Andrew? Were you in high school, college, raising kids? Maybe you were in a band. Tell us what was going on in your life in 94 and what music you were listening to. Leave a voicemail at 866-939-1612 or post your memory at soundcheck.org. That number again, 866-939-1612. Up next, inside the world of obsessive collectors of 78 RPM records, really rare ones. And later, our home station WNYC is celebrating its 90th birthday this week, and in honor of that, we've unearthed a recording of Lead Belly and Woody Guthrie from 1940, performing on the air here at WNYC. We'll listen in later on Soundcheck. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. For a great many people, music is a very serious thing. I wouldn't be sitting here behind a mic, for example, if I didn't think music was something worth an endless amount of talking and debate. But for a very small but influential group of music fans, there's nothing more serious than the 78 RPM record. Music writer Amanda Petrasic has just written a book about that tiny cabal. It's called Do Not Sell at Any Price, The Wild Obsessive Hunt for the World's Rarest 78 RPM Records. She's joining us here in our Soundcheck studio once again. Amanda, good to see you.
Good to see you too, John. Thanks for having me.
And also joining us on the line from Charlottesville, Virginia, is Chris King, who is one of the quote-unquote obsessives referenced in the book's subtitle, as well as a dedicated preservationist of 78 RPM records. And Chris, good to have you back on the show too.
Thanks, John. I appreciate it.
So, Amanda, it's a great read. I mean, it's a fun story to follow your adventures and misadventures in, you know, getting into the world of 78 RPM collecting and rarities and stuff. You've written about Americana before.
I have, yeah.
How did that lead you down this road somehow?
A little bit, sure. I had written a bit about pre-war vernacular American music and was kind of passingly familiar with 78, but I'd never really held one in my hands. I'd kind of come to this music via reissue compilations, some of which were produced by Chris, in fact. And I'd been working on a magazine story, I guess it must have been around 2007, a story for Spin magazine about the commercial resurgence of vinyl records, which at the time had this kind of noteworthy increase in distribution and sales. I think it was the news peg for that story was that Nine Inch Nails and Metallica had suddenly just reissued their whole back catalogs on vinyl. And I had interviewed a guy named Mike Lupica, who was then the director of the WFMU record fair. Mm-hmm. And I was talking to him and sort of trying to get in touch with some record collectors who maybe, you know, would be willing to talk to me a little bit about digital music. And he said, you know, I can introduce you to plenty of guys who are obsessed with LPs, but if you really want to talk to someone who's totally bonkers, you need to find a 78 collector. And I remember thinking, okay, I kind of know what a 78 is. You know, I'm familiar with this music, but I had no idea what was in store for me.
And down the rabbit hole you went.
Down the rabbit hole I went. Face first.
Now, Chris, Amanda talks about, you know, starting to write about vinyl. It's worth noting right off the bat that 78 RPM records are not made of vinyl, right?
No, they are not, no. They're composed of various things ranging from clay to shellac to ground-up chairs and bovine bones.
Is that true?
Yeah. I mean, the early Paramount label, in order to cut corners and to maximize profitability, they threw just about anything into their shellac mix, including ground up bureaus that couldn't be shipped out and bones and just about anything that they could find, clay from the river up there.
Wow. Because Paramount, where were they based? Was that Wisconsin?
One Grafton of and Port Washington, Wisconsin.
Wisconsin, yeah. Chris, what was your initial reaction when, you know, Amanda came calling and said, I want to talk to you about 78 RPM records and rarities and collecting, etc.?
Well, I mean, it would be not dissimilar from somebody asking a stamp collector that they want to talk about stamps. To me, it's a relatively harmless activity on the outside that people just do to prolong their lives. Of course, it had a deeper meaning to me, and when I met Amanda and was talking with her, I did want to try to forewarn her that I'm not the typical 78 collector.
What is the typical 78 collector?
Well, it's the one who tries to project I guess, a whole panorama of neuroses and antisocial behavior, and they're sort of proud of that badge.
Mm. Amanda, you have some fairly colorful and not very flattering descriptions of what the, you know, what the idealized, what the stereotypical 78 collector is like.
Yeah, I mean, I think people think of, you know, Steve Buscemi in Ghost World, or they think of the comic book guy from The Simpsons. And I certainly was sympathetic. I think as a music fan off the bat, was sympathetic with the desire to kind of corral and possess these recordings that are so powerful and so rare and so sort of high stakes.
Well, and one of the things you write about Chris is that, you know, he's not one of those people that, you know, he's all about collecting the songs as opposed to the discs. That's how you put it. Chris, did that ring true to you?
Yeah, I'm vastly more interested in the performance, in the instantaneous occurrence, and what that occurrence is supposed to do to the listener and to the musician at the same time, rather than the physical artifact. I mean, the artifact is a vehicle that contains all that, but it's not about the vehicle. It's about the performance, about the sort of spiritual incorporeality of the whole thing.
Now, one of the songs, Amanda, that you write about has gotten a bit of press lately, and that is Geechee Wiley's Last Kind Word Blues, a song that has been a kind of holy grail for a lot of collectors for many years. John Jeremiah Sullivan recently wrote a big article in the New York Times Sunday Magazine about L.V. Thomas and Geechee Wiley. So what is it about this record that, you know, makes it kind of iconic in those circles?
Sure. I mean, that record, it's probably my favorite record. It was certainly the first thing I asked Chris, who was fortunate enough to own a copy of that record. Every time I think of Last Kind Word Blues, I think of that quote from Barry Hanna at the beginning of Geronimo Rex, where he says, you know, he's talking about seeing a band for the first time, and he said, they made you want to pick up a knife and get killed somewhere. Sort of how I feel about Last Kind
Word
Blues.
But in a good way.
In a great way. I mean, in an incredible way. That song just destroys me in a way. And I talk a little bit in the book about my own sort of personal journey with this material and feeling in the moment in which I started working on it, feeling a little disillusioned with a lot of contemporary music, which was my fault. It was certainly not the fault of performers releasing records now. But that song in particular was something that I think kind of reawakened a sense in me of what music could do, of how transformative and powerful it could be.
Let's hear a little bit of it. This is The Last Kind Word Blues by Geechee Wiley.
The last kind word I hear my daddy say, Lord, the last kind word I hear my daddy say. If I die in the German war, I want to send my body, send it to my mother-in-law. If I get killed, please don't bury my soul. I can't just leave me out.
Just a little bit of The Last Kind Word Blues by Geechee Wiley, about whom we know almost nothing. She didn't record all that much. Amanda Petrusich talks about this record and so many of the other world's rarest 78 RPM discs in her new book called Do Not Sell at Any Price. There's an entire chapter in which she goes record hunting with Chris King, who's also on the line with us, the engineer and producer of vintage music compilations like People Take Warning, a collection of murder ballads and disaster songs. Now, Amanda, you were talking about, you know, this song kind of destroys you every time. I've heard this song a lot over the years, and the thing that strikes me is when she first starts singing, it's not the note you expect.
Yeah.
You know, it just, there's a little guitar intro, and you kind of think you know where, but she comes in lower than you expect, and right away, the little hairs on the back of your neck stand up. Does it matter to you that the record is exceedingly rare? Does that add something, a frisson of something to the experience?
Sure. I mean, that's a great question, and in many ways is one of the central questions of the book, the extent to which rarity sort of infects our sense of what music is worth or what it means. I don't know. I feel like it would be almost naive of me to say, no, it doesn't matter. I don't care. And certainly it is available in infinite quantities in a digital format. But I do think the fact that Wiley was such a cipher, that there was so little we knew about her. We know a little bit more now, thanks to folks like John Jeremiah Sullivan and his research assistants. But I do think that sense of it being almost like a secret, especially hearing it on 78, which I would argue is a kind of different experience than hearing a digital reissue of that song. Yes, I would like to say no, but I think that the answer is probably yes.
So, Chris, you own a copy, a 78 RPM copy of that, right?
Yes.
How many are there?
There's between 2 and 3.
Does that mean 2.5?
Well, I mean, I can only verify my own copy and the copy that was in Don Kent's collection,
okay,
which now resides in John Tefteller's collection. I can't verify any others. There is a rumor that there's another copy floating around.
I know there's, when R. Crumb was here in our studio with John Hanahan, who's also Amanda in your book, there's that moment in the Crumb movie where he's shown pulling a record out of his collection and putting it on the turntable on the Victrola. And what we hear is The Last Kind Word Blues. So I asked him about that. I said, so you actually own a copy of this? And he said, no, I wish. It was like, that was just some other record. And when they made the movie, it was the Geechee Wiley that they tracked in there.
Yeah.
But, you know, so to him, to R. Crumb, to John Hanahan, to all these people, this is like an object of desire. Lucky you. So, Chris, how did you become, so fascinated, not just with 78 RPM discs in general, but particularly the country blues, the Blind Lemon Jeffersons, the Blind Willie Johnsons, the Geechee Wileys, etc.?
Well, I mean, I got first interested in that material when I junked a small stack of discs on my grandparents' farm that were in a sharecropper shack. And in that box, among those things, was Blind Willie Johnson, God Don't Never Change. And there was some Cajun material, lots of Sanctified material, and, of course, the sort of deep country blues.
That God, I don't never change. He's God, always will be God. God in the middle of the ocean, God in the middle of the sea, by the help of the great creator, truly been a God to me. He's God. God don't never change. God always will be God. God in the creation, God when Adam fell, God way up in heaven, God way down in hell. He's God. God don't never change. God always will be God.
It seemed to possess a raw, unvarnished, purely emotive essence to it, and I just sort of became very curious, and I had to have more and more and more.
How old were you then?
Oh, geez. It was pre-puberty, at least.
No, oh, wow.
Yeah.
So what?
It replaced puberty for a while, thankfully.
When we get to talking, Amanda, about records of which there are 2 known copies, maybe 3 known copies, your title, Do Not Sell at Any Price, begins to make sense. I mean, these things might be worth, the material that they're made from might be almost worthless, but the value to a collector of something that rare is off the charts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's incredible. I remember an early interview I did with John, who you were speaking about earlier. And
John Hanahan.
Yeah, and him saying, I can't say it on the radio, but it was, the sense of the blank you, I'll pay more sort of collector's economy, that was kind of linchpin of the collector's economy. And it's true. Yes, they are objectively worthless. I mean, they're not made of gold, but they're extraordinary rarity. And also, certainly, I think the attachment, the kind of emotional attachment that people can make, that a collector or fan can make with a piece of art, I think draws those prices.
So is there a record price for a 78 RPM? They come on the market so rarely, it seems.
Yeah, I feel like once a year a kind of significant discovery will be made. And Chris can talk a little bit more about this. There was a J.D. Short Paramount record that had never been heard before that was recently discovered, I believe, in East Tennessee and was acquired by John Tefteller, who's one of the collectors featured in the book. You know, and that there was a Sun House record that was found in Philadelphia, I think at a Salvation Army a few years ago. Chris and I came very close when we were at the Hillsville Flea Market in Hillsville, Virginia, to finding a copy of a Blind Blake record that would have been, I believe, the only known copy of that record. It does happen from time to time.
How do you know you came close?
Maybe I'll let Chris tell that story.
Oh, no, you're the storyteller. Right? Go ahead.
Yeah, but that was an evil little giggle there, Chris, so I want to hear what's behind it.
Well, I mean, the evilness is that, you know, there was no way that we could have second-guessed what occurred. And on the same note, even though I probably would have bought it, I probably would not have kept it due to its condition. I mean, from what I understand, after it was turned up, it's in G-minus condition, basically played to death, played with a rusty old needle.
So you got there and found that someone had just bought
this
thing.
Yeah, well, I had kind of badgered Chris into letting me tag along with him on a junking mission to this flea market in southwestern Virginia, where he has gone for many years. And that area, I think, historically has been kind of a hotbed for 78 finds. It's a good place to go looking for records. And Chris knew that and had been and had found some great things there in the past. And so we drove over the night before, spent the night in a hotel room in Christiansburg, Virginia, got up at kind of the crack of dawn to get there right as the flea market opened, which is, you know, how these things work. And when we arrived, we chatted a little bit with the record dealer who Chris sort of knew was the guy who had the stuff, if the stuff was to be had. And he had mentioned that he had already sold a bunch of records to a man from Raleigh. And, of course, my sense of sort of propriety was offended because, you know, the flea market had technically just opened. I don't really think he was supposed to be doing
that. He sold them 5 days earlier.
Yeah, they had been camped out in the field, and I think people had just gotten there before us. And it was later revealed that was where that Blind Blake record had been bought.
Wow.
So it did. I feel like it kind of got bought out from under us a little bit, although I feel like I was maybe more devastated by that than Chris. Chris laughed it off days later, and I was, you know, crying.
I'm still laughing it off.
Yeah, he's still laughing there in Charlottesville, Virginia.
Yeah, I mean, we can't really have gone to the flea market 5 days or 7 days or 8 or 9 or 10 days and camped out there in anticipation of not knowing what was going to occur. So there's really no way you can second guess this.
Chris King's on the line with us from Virginia. Amanda Petrusich, the author of the new book, Do Not Sell at Any Price, is here with me in the studio. The book talks about her wild, obsessive hunt for the world's rarest 78 RPM records. You are almost fixated, it seems, on a certain Skip James record. Mm. Tell us why.
Well, sure. I think I, like many, am just kind of captivated in a very unholy way by Skip James's Devil Got My Woman. And that was one of the first 78s I had heard, certainly in the movie Ghost World, in Terry Zwigoff's movie Ghost World. There's this great scene about that record that I feel like kind of sums it up, where Steve Buscemi's character plays that song for Thora Birch's character, and she says, I want to hear more like that, and he says there aren't any other records like that.
Well, how many copies of this record are there that we know of?
I believe there are 2 or 3. Chris, maybe you can confirm that.
Well, and once again, it's one of those wildly mythological records. I mean, I've heard figures as high as 5 or 6, but I think in terms of playable copies, 1 or 2 at tops.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, let's hear a little bit of Skip James' song, Devil Got My Woman. Is the great Nehemiah James, better known as Skip James to music fans and collectors. Devil Got My Woman, and one or two playable copies of this are known to exist, and it is part of the story of Amanda Petrosich's new book, Do Not Sell at Any Price, The Wild Obsessive Hunt for the World's Rarest 78 RPM Records. Chris King is in the book and has been on soundcheck previously for his compilation called People Take Warning, Murder Ballads and Disaster Songs, 1913 to 1938, among numerous other things. And Chris, I guess my question to you is, do I need to care if there are one or two or 10 or 100 copies of a record if people like you can come along and, you know, lovingly preserve and make them playable, and then we get to hear them digitally? Does it matter?
Well, probably Amanda and I would get into fisticuffs over this, but to me it doesn't really matter how rare something is. It is simply the fact that one preserves it and then midwifes it into a process of presenting it and preserving it for the rest of humanity. That's really ultimately the big deal. That's the importance of it.
And in terms, Amanda, of, you know, you said before, hearing it from a 78 is a different experience. I mean, it seems to me that, you know, for all its flaws, you know, people say digital is, you know, there's no headroom, it doesn't have the same kind of acoustic resonance as vinyl. It seems to me this is a very good use of digital technology to take these very poorly recorded songs at times and make them audible and playable for everybody.
Right, absolutely. I mean, that's certainly true. And 78's a kind of challenge of 78's for a person who's maybe just beginning to get into this material is they don't sound good. I mean, it's not exactly like a vinyl record. You can listen to a 78 for the first time and it sounds terrible in many ways. And I think the engineering work that gets done on these records by Chris and by folks like Richard Nevins is really remarkable. It feels like an act of magic to me sometimes what they can make these recordings sound like without compromising the integrity of the disc. But for me, and I hate to say this almost, I'm almost embarrassed to say it, but there is something about the tactile experience of hearing a 78 and not a kind of digital re-representation of a performance. There was something really intoxicating about it, and I think maybe
you've drunk the Kool-Aid, haven't you?
Absolutely, I've bathed in the Kool-Aid, unfortunately. And I think Chris would agree. I mean, I think if either of us were to suggest we, you know, show up in Chris's music room and remove all of his 78s and replace them with a flash drive, I would pay millions of dollars to see the look on his face.
Amanda's correct that the actual experience of hearing the 78 within the context of a nice, relaxed record room like mine in a chair and you're sipping whiskey and you just had a good dinner. I mean, that's an excellent experience. It just, I can't fit 5, 6, 7,000 people in my room at one time.
Right, right. Now, Chris, we mentioned before there are collectors who, you know, they're kind of like art collectors where they, you know, they just want to have the item. You are the type who wants to have the song and then share it as widely as possible. Tell us about your most recent compilation, which takes you to a different part of the world.
Oh, yeah, with Alexis Zumbas. Yeah, I had discovered the music from northern Greece and southern Albania a few years ago when I took my family on vacation to Istanbul. And having acquired a rather large collection of this material because of its spiritual effect on me, I then ran across this artist, Alexis Zumbas, who was from Yanina, the main town in northern Greece. And I became so obsessed and fixated not only upon his music, but what his music was intended to have upon the listeners, what it was supposed to do, that I had to find out more about his life and ended up traveling to northern Greece to a very remote village and interviewing his two surviving nephews, as well as accumulating all the documents about his life while he was in New York City and Chicago and then later in Detroit where he died.
Hmm. So this is rebetika music, right?
No, it's eprotika. Rebetika is sort of the popular urban music of Greece, particularly of Athens.
Okay.
Eprotika is sort of hypnotic mountain music from the highlands where they would have used this music to entertain villagers, and also to sort of mesmerize sheep and make sheep do what they want them to do.
Okay. I guess if you can charm snakes, you can do it to sheep, too.
You can do it to sheep.
Has that effect on humans a little bit, too, I think.
Well, so we're going to hear a little bit of this compilation to wrap up. But before we do, Soundcheck listeners, check out our website, soundcheck.org, for more songs picked for us by Amanda Petrusich and Chris King. Amanda's new book is called Do Not Sell at Any Price, The Wild Obsessive Hunt for the World's Rarest 78 RPM Records. And both Amanda and Chris will be at the Book Court in Brooklyn on July 11th, along with guitarist and collector Nathan Salzberg, another Soundcheck alumnus. Chris, Amanda, thank you both for being with us.
Thank you, John.
Thank you, John.
That's the Greek musician Alexis Zumbas with the Zamara Arvanitiko from Chris King's recent compilation called A Lament for Epirus, 1926 to 1928. Up next, we'll hear another very rare bit of audio, this one from the WNYC Radio Archives. The host of the show was Leadbelly, and his on-air guest, Woody Guthrie. That's next on Soundcheck. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. We're celebrating 90 years of broadcasting here at our home station, WNYC, this week. WNYC Radio was founded by the City of New York back in 1924, and soon after, started playing music on the air. Now, through the next few days, we'll be listening back to some of the incredible musical moments that have happened on WNYC's airwaves over the past 90 years, including this one.
Good afternoon. Your municipal station presents another in the series Folk Songs of America, featuring that great Negro folk singer of Louisiana, Hildy Leadbetter, better known to you as Leadbelly. And Leadbelly has as his guest today the dustiest dust bowler of them all, Woody Guthrie of Oklahoma.
This is an episode of a WNYC show called Folk Songs of America, from December 12, 1940. In just a minute, we'll hear more of the program, but first, joining me in the Soundcheck studio is Eli Smith, founder of the Brooklyn Folk Festival and host of the Down Home Radio Show podcast series. Eli, welcome back.
Hi, thank you.
This is not the first time you've heard this little bit of audio, is it?
No, Henrietta Yurchenko, that we're going to be talking about, first had me come down to the WNYC archives and get it a number of years ago. I've heard it a lot.
Henrietta Yurchenko co-founded the Down Home Radio Show with you after a long career as an ethnomusicologist and several historic stints here at WNYC.
Oh, yes, definitely. Henrietta Yurchenko was a pioneering ethnomusicologist and folklorist. She did the pioneering fieldwork among Aztec and Inca indigenous people in Mexico.
Right, right.
In the mid-40s, and just incredible, incredible folkloric work all around the world. But she was a pioneering radio host and producer also, starting here on WNYC. She did incredible work on the radio here in the early 40s and then again in the 60s.
Right. One of the very early interviews with Bob Dylan back in the 60s. And in 1940, that show we were just hearing the beginning of, Folk Songs of America, hosted by Leadbelly, she produced that.
She was Leadbelly's producer of the radio show that he had, and she also had her own shows. But, yeah, it's incredible. Yeah, she started, I guess, in early 1940. She was really young.
Now, how unusual was it? I mean, I've listened to some of the old, you know, discs that we have of WNYC's history. It's all dudes, except for Henrietta.
Yeah. She was a remarkable woman that broke the bounds of sexism and throughout her career.
We're speaking with Eli Smith, founder of the Brooklyn Folk Festival and co-founder, along with the late Henrietta Yurchenko, of the Down Home Radio Show. And Henrietta was the producer of Lead Belly's WNYC series called Folk Songs of America from, it was 1940, it might have gone a year or two into the 40s.
She left for Mexico in like late 41 or something like that. So this, in her initial foray into radio on WNYC, was only a year or a year and a half.
Right. And then she came back in the 60s. Yeah. So this clip from that this show that we heard that little clip from, we can return to it now. She was what, 90 years old when you and Henrietta sat down to rebroadcast this tape from our archives?
Henrietta was, I believe, 90 when we put out this show. I would go to her apartment on 9th Avenue, and we would record these radio shows. It was great fun for her and great fun for me as well. We had a wonderful time together.
Well, this is a 2007 episode of the Down Home Radio Show with the former WNYC producer Henrietta Yurchenko, and here she is talking about her memories of working with both Lead Belly and Lead Belly's guest, Woody Guthrie.
Lead Belly used to come to the station every single week, and he was immaculately dressed. A gray suit, double-breasted suit, the pants beautifully creased, a white shirt, a black bow tie, carrying his 12-string guitar.
And his startlingly white hair.
Yes. Yeah. The interesting thing was, on that particular broadcast, Woody appeared, and as soon as the engineers came in and set up the microphones, Woody just, you know, fooling around, began to sing a rather bawdy songs. Lead Belly would have none of it. He said, now, Woody, you dasn't sing that song on my program. But of course, Woody never would have sung it. It was just for fun.
Henrietta Yurchenko, the late WNYC producer, and a 2007 episode of the Down Home Radio Show, which she co-founded with my guest, Eli Smith, who you also heard there in that clip. So this is you and Henrietta talking about the 1940 transcription disc. Explain what a transcription disc is and how you got hold of it.
Well, Henrietta got a call from Andy Lancet, who's the archivist at WNYC, saying that this disc had been discovered in the home of the old, you know, station manager of WNYC. And it's a 16-inch acetate disc. This was before the days of tape recording.
Right.
So you had to record right onto a disc. And that was how radio shows were recorded, and then they could be rebroadcast later.
It's not something that was done a lot, you know. It wasn't like every show got recorded.
This is very special.
Yeah.
And the quality is incredible. It sounds really good.
You know, when I first got to WNYC, we used to use those huge transcription discs. We'd drill holes through them and attach keys to them, so you didn't lose the key to the music library or something. It would be on a transcription disc. I don't want to think about what else was on that transcription disc that is now unplayable, but we have this one. And this episode in particular is about ballads. And here again is Henrietta Yurchenko talking about how important it was to have these ballads being sung back then.
Ballads are story songs. And before the day when you had radio and movies to tell stories, you know, ballads were the way you told the story. Most of the stories had to do with people's very, very personal lives. That means really around the world. All the scandals, you know, all the murders, whatever there was in the way of sensational news was communicated.
So that's basically what you and Henrietta hear in this series. It's actually two transcription discs, right?
That's right, yeah.
Because they only fit about 10, 15 minutes of music on each one.
Right, and it was a half-hour program.
All right, and so during the course of the program, Eli and Henrietta are rebroadcasting this 1940 show from the WNYC archives in which Woody Guthrie and Lead Belly are taking turns, and they're playing some songs that would become really well known.
Oh, yeah.
At one point, Leadbelly does a version of Frankie and Johnny, except he changes it to Frankie and Albert. Listen.
Now, this is Frankie and Albert. Frankie was a hard-working guy. Worked hard in the white folk kitchen. Albert, he wasn't no good. And so Frankie made $100 and paid it all for Albert one suit of clothes. And now this will tell the story about Frankie and Albert. Frankie was a woman, everybody know. Made $100 just to buy a man a suit of clothes. Was a man called it down around. Frank, she went out walking, did not go for fun. Get on the apron. Albert smoked at 41. Gonna kill my man. All it done, you know.
That is Leadbelly performing live in the WNYC studio back in December of 1940. And on Soundcheck today, it's a part of our ongoing series celebrating 90 years of broadcasting here at WNYC. My guest is Eli Smith, founder of the Brooklyn Folk Festival and the co-host for a couple of years with Henrietta Yurchenko of the Down Home Radio Show. You guys founded the show in, what, 2006?
That's right. It was a podcast that we started together in 2006, and people can hear all the episodes of that show on downhomeradioshow.com, including this full broadcast that we're hearing excerpts from now, as well as a number of other shows that I did with Henrietta where we play her field recordings that she made mm-hmm. over the years and archival stuff, great stuff.
And Henrietta was the producer of Leadbelly's WNYC show called Folk Songs of America back in 1940 and 41, and then hosted a folk music program here at WNYC throughout much of the 60s as well. In this show, we also hear Woody Guthrie singing, and I should say, you know, you can hear the full versions of these songs, the full version of the show, on our website as well at soundcheck.org. Woody Guthrie sings what was then a new song, The Ballad of Tom Joad.
He had just written Tom Joad. Incredible, the ballad that he wrote based on the story of John Steinbeck's Grapes of Wrath. Incredible song, moving song.
And a very funny introduction where he says, you know, I didn't read the book, but I've seen the film three times.
Right. He'd read the book multiple times. We have his copy with, you know, notations in the margins and everything.
Right. So he was just putting on a little show for the people.
Yeah,
there.
Sure.
Woody Guthrie live in 1940 on WNYC, setting up the song and playing a bit of it on Leadbelly's show called Folk Songs of America.
Well, I think now we're going to sing you one. Here's a song here that has to do with a book and a motion picture that come out here a while back by the name of The Grapes of Wrath, wrote down by a man, John Steinbeck, that threw the pack on his back and went right out amongst the people to see just what is going on in the United States. And it just so happened that he hit a jackpot because he knew what where he was going. He knew what he was writing about. So, I didn't read the book, but then I seen the picture three times, and I come home and I sat down and I wrote up a little piece about it. The name of this is The Ballad of Tom Joad. Tom Joad got out of that old McAllister pen. There he got his parole. After 4 long years on a man-killing charge, Tom Joad come a-walking down the road, poor boy. Tom Joad come a-walking down the road. It was there he found him a truck-driving man. There he got him a ride. Said, I just got a loose from the old penitentiary. Charge called home, he sighed. Poor boy, it was a charge called home, he sighed.
That is Woody Guthrie, live on WNYC, on Leadbelly's show called Folk Songs of America, recorded in December of 1940 and produced by Henrietta Yurchenko, who, along with my guest Eli Smith, was a co-founder and host of the Down Home Radio Show, which actually rebroadcast this WNYC bit of history back in 2007. Eli's with me in the soundcheck studio today. Tom Joad is set by Woody Guthrie to a familiar melody. It's the same melody that John Hardy is often sung to.
Right, yeah, Woody Guthrie may have never written an original melody. He just wrote beautiful lyrics and had a great knowledge of folk music and rural American music to draw upon.
So this show that we're listening to, these excerpts of Lead Belly and Woody Guthrie, would Henrietta have brought them together? Did they know each other independent of Henrietta?
They probably did know each other independently, but it's remarkable to hear them both on this broadcast. They were all part of a really interesting milieu in New York at that time. It was a different world then. There was a whole crew of people, including Henrietta, Woody Guthrie, Lead Belly, Alan Lomax, a young Pete Seeger, and they were lifelong friends, Pete and Henrietta. And they were all in this politically progressive, milieu that was trying to create an alternative to what they saw as a corrupt, the corrupt capitalist, music industry and stuff like that.
And so Lead Belly traveled easily in that circle, but you and Henrietta in this 2007 show also talk about Lead Belly and his place within the specifically African-American community here in New York, which was, well, let's listen. Here's Henrietta talking about Lead Belly's relationship to, for example, Harlem.
Even though he arrived here in New York when the Harlem Renaissance was over, I have to say that the intellectuals of Harlem never recognized him. He was too country, too crude, for them, because after all, they were into fine literature. I think also very interesting that it was Lead Belly who had a tremendous influence on the growing audience, or rather participants in folk music at that time. As far as most people were concerned, particularly musicians and classical musicians, blues was really a very, very primitive form of music because all you had were three chords.
Right, crude.
Yeah, and they only thought in terms of harmony. Whereas, of course, there was such a rich repertory of guitar styles as well as other styles, ensembles, piano styles, and all of that. And it is really Lead Belly that led these youngsters here in the city of New York to understand and to play.
So you heard Henrietta Yurchenko, the late ethnomusicologist and WNYC producer, and my guest Eli Smith there in 2007 edition of their podcast, The Down Home Radio Show, talking about Lead Belly. And she mentions how the intellectuals of Harlem sort of looked down their noses at Lead Belly. And the irony is that Lead Belly was a pretty intelligent guy. He could do a lot more than just the blues or folk music. I mean, it's known that he played many other kinds of music.
Lead Belly was an outstanding folk performer, a real virtuoso, but he didn't fit in the kind of maybe literary circles, or his music was pretty far removed from Count Basie or something.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But I think even among African American cultural workers now, I think, and the population at large, we can look back and realize now just how rich Lead Belly's music was, and he wasn't a country rube. He was really a phenomenal character.
Exactly. Yeah. Now, and as Henrietta says, a sharp-dressed character as well.
Yes.
Now, at the time of Henrietta's show, this 1940 broadcast with Lead Belly and Woody Guthrie, where was Lead Belly in his career?
Lead Belly had made it out of a bad situation in the Deep South and moved to New York, in 1935.
By bad situation, you mean prison?
Yeah, he'd been in jail. He'd had problems with the law, but with the help of the Lomax family, he made it out of there, and he made it to New York. And you can kind of see his arrival in New York City in some ways as the birth of the modern folk music movement in New York, which continues up until today.
Mm-hmm. So the show that we've been listening to excerpts from, originally recorded in 1940, you and Henrietta rebroadcast it in 2007, and folks can hear the entire show on our website and on the Down Home Radio Show podcast. It is definitely worth checking out. And Eli Smith, the founder of the Brooklyn Folk Festival and the co-host of the Down Home Radio Show with the late Henrietta Yurchenko, has been with me here on Soundcheck today. Eli, good to see you again.
Thank you, and it was a big honor for me to work with Henrietta Yurchenko. I was right out of college, and she was at the end of her long and illustrious career, and it was an honor to know her, and I'm so pleased to see her remembered here today. So thank you.
And you can check out more great audio from WNYC's archives as part of our 90th anniversary programming at WNYC.org/90.
If I were he said to the merchant, I never made but one veil. Before I let you have that last one, I will suffer and die in jail. And I'll have a home, and I'll have a home. Now, if anybody should ask you people who composed this song, tell them it's Huddy Ledbetter. He's just been here and gone. He's looking for home. He's looking for home.
That's Leadbelly singing the song Boll Weevil on WNYC back in 1940, part of our celebration all this week of WNYC's 90th birthday. Our thanks to archivist Andy Lancet and the whole archives crew at WNYC. And if you'd like to hear more, and there is so much more, some fascinating stuff, it's all online at WNYC.org/90. But for now, let's go back to where we started, in 1994, 20 years ago, with a song made famous first by Leadbelly, and then later by Kurt Cobain. It goes by several names, but in this case, Nirvana called it Where Did You Sleep Last Night, and used it to close their famous Unplugged performance for MTV. Now, that set first aired in late 93, but it was shown repeatedly after Kurt Cobain's suicide in April of 94. So if you were watching MTV in that summer 20 years ago, there was a good chance that you may have watched that special, Nirvana Unplugged in New York. Here is Kurt Cobain and Nirvana with their take on Leadbelly's Where Did You Sleep Last Night?
My girl, don't lie to me. Tell me, where did you sleep last night? In the pines, where the sun don't ever shine. I would shiver the whole night through. Girl, my girl, where will you go? I'm going where the cold wind blows. In the pines, where the sun don't ever shine. I would shiver the whole night through. The husband was a hard-working man, just about a mile from here. His head was found in a driving wheel, on his body
Nirvana, Unplugged in New York, with a version of a song first made famous by Leadbelly, called, in this version, Where Did You Sleep Last Night? Tomorrow on the show, Nora Jones has teamed up with her friends and fellow songwriters Sasha Dobson and Catherine Popper for a country-fried trio called Puss in Boots. They'll join us to play songs from their new album, plus a look back at the classic Beatles film, A Hard Day's Night. And all this month on Soundcheck, it's the anniversary of the summer of 94. We're celebrating music and memories from that summer 20 years ago. Here's what Kim from New York left on our website. I was 24 and kicked off the summer by breaking up with someone I'd been involved with for 5 years. So that was the summer of breakup recovery, which meant I had Alanis Morissette's You Ought to Know and Tori Amos's God on heavy repeat, as well as my 2-year-old copy of Peter Gabriel's Us, an album which I think should just be issued to everyone going through a breakup.
Something in me, dark and sticky.
We'll leave you tonight with Digging in the Dirt by Peter Gabriel from that album Us. Tell us what you were doing in that summer of 94 and what you were listening to. You can leave your tale at soundcheck.org or leave us a voicemail at 866-939-1612. That does it for the show today. I'm John Schaefer. This is Soundcheck.
Close on you.